Cosima is a new play coming to Smock Alley Theatre. It tells the largely untold story of the composer Richard Wagner's wife, the woman behind the Bayreuth Music Festival held every year in late July. Cosima was the daughter of Franz Liszt and became the wife and muse of Wagner, the great German composer. Cosima, the play, puts the daughter and wife of the two great composers at the centre of the stage. It's a one-woman show performed by Mary Murray, and the play was written by Sheena Lambert. And Sheena joins me now. Sheena, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about Cosima. She was the daughter of the great Franz Liszt, the great composer and pianist, but she was a frustrated artist herself.
Yeah, I believe so. I first came across her studying music myself in the College of Music back in the late 80s, when she was very much referred to just as daughter of, wife of, and let's leave it at that. And in the same vein, you might have heard mention of Clara Schumann, but that was it. There were no more women spoken of. But she always sort of was interesting to me, the idea of having this super famous father who almost like a Taylor Swift-esque fame of the time, and her own musical ability, and then her going on to be this muse to this other amazing composer. It always struck me as there was more there to be told. So the more I looked into her and researched her, the more I realised there certainly was more there to tell.
Now, in your script, she rarely saw her father because he was a superstar. As you say, Taylor Swift-like, spent his life on tour and liked being on tour.
That's right. Yeah, he was really... They coined the phrase listomania about him. So it was listomania comes to Paris when he used to come to perform. And he was known for his making women swoon at his concerts. And literally, there'd be guys selling his gloves with his face on outside his concerts, which, you know, is quite astonishing to think of in the mid-1800s. So there was literally merch going on, like for a list. But yeah, so Cosima herself was, she had an interesting upbringing insofar as her mother and father were both artists. Her mother was a novelist and a writer. And obviously Liszt was a concert pianist and performing all around Europe throughout her young age. And so she didn't really see her parents that much as a child. So when she did see him, it was quite the phenomenon insofar as it was her seeing her father, but also seeing this amazing artist that she would have followed through newspaper articles, literally.
And the play opens with her with one of these very random visits by the father.
Yes.
And she wants to impress him.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, my belief and what was from my research of her life, what was so interesting to me was that she had this dream to follow in her father's footsteps, to be a concert pianist. She certainly had the talent. She physically had the hands. She had those long Liszt fingers. And so when she eventually got a chance to actually see her father, she was very keen to kind of get this idea across to him that she could follow in his footsteps. But really, and what I think set her on the course of her most extraordinary life was the fact that her father was just not on the same page, was not interested in having a daughter who might take a little of his limelight.
And she knew about Clara Schumann, and she knew that Clara Schumann did have a career.
That's right. And Clara Schumann had a father who was very supportive of her, because she was certainly making money, so he very much liked her to be touring, whereas Liszt didn't need any of that. He already had all the fame and he certainly didn't want to share it with his daughter. There was also, I think, the fact that her mother had written a sort of a tell-all. We'd nearly call it a memoir now, a tell-all memoir, whereby she sort of told tales about Liszt and his musical abilities as much as anything else. And I think really part of the reason he wouldn't let Cosima be the musician she always wanted to be was as a little bit of revenge on her mother too. He had very particular ideas, I think, about where women belonged in the whole business of music, and that was in the audience.
Yes, it sure wasn't touring. So she wants, when Liszt comes home, she wants to play a scherzo for him, one of his own scherzos. So we're going to play that now. This is performed by Svetoslav Richter, and it's Liszt's scherzo in G minor. that's one of Liszt's compositions. It's called Scherzo. And I'm here with Sheena Lambert, whose play Cosima is going on at Smock Alley. And you have written the story of Cosima, told from her own point of view, based on her diaries.
Yeah, I had originally, I was writing novels when I started to research Cosima, and I had thought I would write a novel that was kind of a dramatization of her extraordinary life. But the more I researched her and the more I got excited about the story, the more I felt it belonged on a screen. And it was just coming to life to me so visually. So I actually originally wrote a feature screenplay, which Screen Ireland were very supportive, or continue to be very supportive of. And that's sort of a bigger beast, if you like. It's obviously, it's a feature film is a very different thing to a one woman show on a 1 hour sort of stage show. But what happened really after I had finished writing the feature film was, it was almost as if Cosima was still talking to me in my ear. At that point, I felt I knew her so well, warts and all. And I could just see her talking to me, telling me her story, like in a very sassy way, because I think she was a very sassy person. So again, then at that point, I was going, I can see it on stage. So I was sort of drawn to the idea of writing this version of it, which, as you say, it's very much her story from her point of view, which is, I think it's interesting because she was very much a woman who wrote her own version of her life, not only retrospectively, but actually while she was still going, she was keeping these diaries of her life with Wagner. But they're very much what she wanted people. She knew people would read them after Wagner's death, after years later. And so they were very much how she wanted the world to perceive them for posterity. So it was a really interesting play to write because I kind of could use that to, you know, for my purposes, so that she's telling her story her way. That's why I think people have referred to it as like a flea bag, because it's almost that sort of one woman sasspot telling her story.
Yes, yes. And there's a lot of nodding and winking to the audience, because we're in on the game as the audience. Yeah. But she never fulfilled her ambition to be a concert pianist herself and to tour, because when she did marry her first husband, he was told by Liszt that she wasn't to perform.
That's
so
right.
But she did get an outlet then once she met Richard Wagner. And was she like his muse, and therefore she just put all her energies into his music and promoting his career?
Exactly that, I think. When she met Richard Wagner for the first time, she was actually only a child when she met him for the very first time, but then she met him shortly after she had gotten married to one of her father's students that she had thought might help her case in terms of continuing her own career. But when Wagner met her, he saw something in her and she recognised that he saw it. So he definitely appreciated her musicianship. She absolutely saw his genius and in his musicianship. And it was, I think, definitely a love story to some point, but also she saw in him a way of achieving all of the ambition that she had sort of bottled up inside her, and an outlet for that. And she went on to almost deify and make, you know, it's almost a cultish surrounding of Wagner, which I would say she was very happy that annoyed her father a little bit, because, you know, there was that element of revenge on her father.
Yes, it's very interesting, because even like they died very, Liszt and Wagner, they died very near each other in time.
Well, yeah, a few years apart. Yeah, yeah.
And when the father died, what music did she play?
So I mean, the ultimate smear on any composer was at his own funeral, her father's funeral. She refused to have any of his own music played. She only had Wagner music played, which was just the ultimate in insult, and was very insulting to Liszt's own followers. So she certainly managed to get her own back at the end.
Okay, well, now she goes on to form this festival that celebrated his work. But you've got another project coming on that we should talk about. This is Boccia.
Yeah, Boccia, that's right. Yeah, I have...
It's a film.
That's right, a feature film. It's just wrapped, actually. And it's a Sina Cahir feature film, so it's Oscar Ilga. It's an adaptation of my own novel, which was published by HarperCollins back in 2015, called The Lake. And so I had adapted it as a screenplay, and the producers, Danu Media in Galway, liked it a lot and wanted to make a film out of it. So TG Cahir came on board and Screen Ireland came on board. And so it's at the moment now in edit and very exciting.
What can you tell us about the plot?
So it's set at one... The reason I started writing the book in the first place was my fascination with these lakes that are have these sort of drowned villages under them. So like the Blessington Lakes, mm-hmm. these man-made lakes mm-hmm. that, you know, are there's such echoes of kind of bitterness and loss around those areas because of what is literally at the bottom of the water. So the idea of, you can kind of very clearly understand what it might have been like for that at that stage for that to have happened. But the generation later was really where I was kind of thinking, what must it have been like for them living with that like shadow over them? So it's literally the story of Peggy Casey, who is one of four siblings, and she is trying her best to keep her family pub together, because ultimately it means keeping the family together. And she's another sassy lady, actually. She's a great character. But a body washes up on the shore of this lake. And of course, it's assumed it's just one from the old cemetery that was washed, that was drowned with the rest of the village, but maybe not. And so a guard is sent, played by Mo Dunford, actually down from Dublin with his Gaeilge Bacach to speak to the locals in the Gaeltacht town. And, you know, you can imagine all sorts ensues.
Indeed. Well, that's
a bit of
great.
A murder
when,
mystery.
When are we going to see that?
Hopefully early in 2025.
Excellent. Well, you've been a busy woman. Sheila Lambert, her play is Cosima. It's directed by Rex Ryan and the solo cast is Mary Murray. It will be on show from the 16th to the 20th of July at Dublin's Smock Alley Theatre. More information available from their website, smockalley.com. Now, themes of loss, homelessness, music, politics, new communities and a coming-of-age drama are featured as part of the 32 Irish films screened at the Galway Film Fla. One of these films, The Wise Guy, will get its first screening on Saturday, the 13th of July, in the Town Hall Theatre in Galway. It is part of a collection of the first feature series at the Galway Film Fla. The Wise Guy tells the story of Francis Burns, a lonely boy who is desperate for guidance and protection, who finds an unconventional mentor hiding in the nearby woods, an American gangster. Making his debut as both a writer and director is Sam O'Mahony, who joins us on the line from Galway. Hello, Sam. How are you?
Hello, how are you? Thanks so much for having me on.
You must be very excited about getting this screening for your debut feature.
I am, absolutely. I mean, it was always our hope that the film would premiere at Galway when we made it last summer. So to not only get the invitation, but to get this brilliant Saturday night slot is, it's a dream come true.
Well, look, tell us a little bit about it. The film centres around Francis Burns, a lonely lost boy. Tell us about Francis.
So, I mean, Francis is, he's a 11-year-old boy. His parents have recently broken up, and on top of everything, he's an almost militant little atheist. So for the first time in his life, he's plunged into what real loneliness means, and suddenly he's desperate for ideas, ways to kind of navigate this first big trauma in his life. And he starts off watching these films that his father left behind, you know, to see if are there answers there. Then he even starts experimenting with Christianity. And finally, you know, it emerges that there's this mysterious man living in the woods beside his father's new house.
Yes, because we see him going to his father, who is now living with a new girlfriend. And the boy is left to his own devices, really, only having a shed to kind of play with. But at least the wood is nearby, and he is an expert on plant life. He's taught himself, self-taught.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, you know, the elements about him is that, you know, as someone who doesn't believe in God, he believes in other things. He believes in nature. He loves trees. He loves movies, you know, and that's where he escapes into. So he kind of goes from this shed and finds this wood and then bumps into this man, and this relationship develops that, you know, initially, you know, turns out to be a wonderful thing for Francis. His confidence is restored. It feels like there's somebody there to kind of guide him through all this pain. But of course, then, you know, there's a darker side, there's a shadow to this relationship that then forces Francis, you know, to really kind of consider what's important in his life and you know, try to get a grapple of reality, because, you know, as with so many coming of ages, everything's about to change. I mean, you know, he's on that cusp. His voice will be broken in 6 months. And I wanted to, you know, feel like this was a portrayal of the end of childhood, you know, okay. And that can be a scary thing, but a really beautiful thing as well.
OK, Sam, let's listen to a clip from your film. This is where Francis, played by Sinan Jennings, discusses the mafia and the omerta with the man he's found in the woods, who may or may not be a gangster. And it's played by Darren De Silva. And there's some language in this clip.
You know what omerta really means? It means to be a real man. The real men, they don't live in the past. The mommy and daddy, fuck that. Real men, they move on. For real men, past never happened. That's how you survive. All right. Let's go plant some fucking spuds.
There we go. That is Darren De Silva as the man in the forest, and he's there with Francis, played by Sinan Jennings. So I can see, I presume you conjured him out of your imagination, but this boy who relies on the movies, you know, going through a hard time in this key part of his life, is that inspired by your own experience, or where does it come from, Sam?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, I think there is, you know, with debut films, there's a tradition of filmmakers exploring their childhood, and certainly, you know, that there are elements in the script that do very much reflect my growing up. My parents separated when I was a kid. My dad moved out to a strange house with a strange woman, and he did, in fact, live next door to a criminal. So there were, you
it's
know,
it's an autobiography.
No. That's about where the
okay,
similarities end. There was no relationship. I never saw that guy. It was a very mysterious character who kind of came and went. But, you know, I think what happens, you know, in those moments in a child's life, and that for me, you know, I think that was probably that first big trauma. And when those things happen, you look for stories, you look for other things to help you out. So certainly, you know, watching movies is, I think, you know, in many ways, it's a search for answers. It's looking for a toolkit to kind of move through things. So yeah, certainly I was watching films I probably shouldn't have at that time, but it also helped me find Scorsese and all these other amazing people that have probably stayed in my life and guided me through it.
Now, there's also a very strong nature theme in this, isn't it? You know, that this boy, not only does he love the wood and could give later he does give a guided tour of the wood to his parents. And also it helps him just readjust in a school where he's not very happy.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, for me, the film is a journey towards embracing reality and the pain of that reality, but also the beauty of reality. You know, as an atheist, you know, we still need to believe in something, and reality has so much. So I think for Francis, nature and the trees and life and the humility that comes with sitting beneath, you know, a tree, the sort of the eternity that brings is something I want to bring in. Because for me, you know, whether you're an atheist or whether you're a Christian, I think ultimately we're the same people. We're all sitting in the dark looking for something to comfort us. For Francis, it's the magnificence of nature.
Now I know loads of first time or hopeful filmmakers are listening and wondering, how did you get it from the page to the screen? What was the pivotal thing that happened for you to get it made?
Honestly, the pivotal thing that happened was that I moved to Belfast. You know, there's a remarkable film community in Belfast. I was living in London. I'd been an actor for 15 years, but I'd stopped for the last few years and was very much pursuing film, which I'd always been pursuing since I was a kid, but began to pursue it properly. And then moved to Belfast and had that script, and suddenly, you know, doors opened and Northern Ireland Screen came on board and they wanted to develop it with me. They then, you know, greenlit it for production. So, you know, that sounds like a bit of a glib answer. Obviously, work. You know, these ideas, if that idea is picking away at your head, write it and write a terrible version of it. And then you will have something to turn into something better some way down the line. After that, then you just have to hope that somebody is going to like it enough to help you make it. And you know, after many years of trying, someone finally did give me that opportunity. So I was absolutely delighted.
Now, you've always been interested in filmmaking, haven't you? You have some stories of when you were a kid and forcing your parents to take you to Wexford.
Yeah. No, I was a stalker of Irish film crews. I mean, I made little films myself, but I would, you know, if I saw trucks parked somewhere, film trucks parked, I would start lingering around that crew until someone gave me a job. I mean, my mother, I convinced her to drive me down to Wexford when they were making Saving Private Ryan, and snuck onto that beach and stood there, you know. During transition year, I went in and worked full time in the props department of this film called The Last September. It was a short-lived career in the props department because I was bringing something into a room, stood on Maggie Smith's foot. She screamed, and I had to make a quick retreat. But
it marked her, but it's marked you too, Irish.
Indeed, yeah. No. It didn't put me off at all. But it's lovely. And then I started acting for years, it feels so right to come back and to be making films. It's the artistic form in which I think I feel so comfortable expressing myself through.
So those actors that we just heard there, Francis Burns, the young man, where did you find him, or did you have anything to do with finding him?
Oh yeah, no, he was, the whole film, this film got greenlit 7 weeks before we started shooting. So, I mean, I had a few ideas for the adult cast and they came together easily enough. Daryl was an actor that I knew from London years ago, and so I was so lucky to get him. But the whole film, I mean, you know, sits on this kid's shoulder. So our casting director, Mary Ellen O'Hara, put out the call, and we got a tape back from this kid called Senan. And honestly, like, his tape just made me laugh so much. But when he came up for his recall, by bizarre coincidence, he said he went to Primrose Hill Primary School in Selbridge. And, I mean, my jaw nearly hit the floor, because that's the school that I actually went to when I was his age.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. So to be writing this kind of, you know, very loose memoir, and then the kid who just blew me out of the park when he did his audition turned out to go to the school that I was at that time. I mean, serendipity, call it what you want. But it was lovely coincidence.
Well, Sam, I hope you have a great success. So best of luck to you and the crew. The Wise Guy is to make its screen debut at the Galway Film Flat tomorrow night. Sam O'Mahony, thank you. It's Friday evening, so it's time to take a listen to the latest album releases. First up is Travis with their 10th studio album, LA Times, bursting onto the scene 25 years ago with their breakout album, The Man Who. Their latest offering sees the band drawing inspiration from frontman Fran Healy's decade-long residence in LA, blending their signature gentle sound with new influences and personal reflections. Next, we have Griff with her highly anticipated debut album, Vertigo. Griff, a rising British pop star, has already garnered significant attention by supporting Taylor Swift and Dua Lipa on tour. With a Brit Award for Rising Star in her pocket and a record deal secured while still in school, Griff's journey to her first full-length album has been remarkable. And finally, Remy Wolf and her second album, Big Ideas. This Californian native first caught the public eye as a contestant on American Idol in 2014, but has since carved out a niche all her own with her eclectic blend of soul, funk and psychedelic pop. I'm joined now by Aoife Barry and Cian Sullivan. But let's start with Travis, and this is Raise the Bar.
It's warm in here. Johnny and Jack are drinking whiskey and beer. Black and white, bittersweet. It's just another night on a one-way street. We are who we are, who we are. They couldn't change us even if they tried.
That's Raise the Bar from LA Times by Travis. So, Aoife, you're a big fan of Travis's breakout album, The Man Who. That was back in 1999. How has LA Times changed?
Hard to believe. I was only 1 or 2 years old.
I know.
I wish. Back in 1999. I mean, they've had an interesting career. I mean, they're a band that, like you're saying, they broke out with that record and they, you know, were kind of mocked a little bit, I suppose, for their soft kind of rock pop sounds. And they haven't changed massively with LA Times. But this record is interesting because Fran Healy, the frontman, lives in LA, and this record is very much a response to what he's seen in his, you know, through his life living in LA. So, for example, he's got a record studio near Skid Row, which is an infamously kind of difficult area of the City of Angels. And he's seen a lot of the contrast between how people live in LA. And if you go there, you'll see the richest people you've ever seen right next to the poorest people you've ever seen. It's really a city of contrast. So he's very much exploring these sorts of ideas there. And the different members of the band have had a lot of difficult things happen in their lives. There's been kind of marriage breakups and they've lost friends and things like that. So there is a slightly like harsher or more difficult side to this record, which does come out lyrically and then can come out a little bit musically as well too, where it's not just a very fey twee pop album, but it does have, like that song you heard there, the very kind of uplifting moments, you know, the kind of lighter in the air moment. So they have definitely kept their original vibe, but they're trying to add those slightly darker elements into it. So I think fans of Travis will find everything that they love here. Newer fans might still, you know, dislike whatever they're doing. But I do think it's good to hear them kind of moving things on a little.
All right. And people dislike them because it's too soft.
They kind of feel like they're, I think they feel that they're almost too nice. And I think that's something that Fran Healy does bring up in interviews. He was talking to, I think it was Ed Power in the Irish Times recently, and was like, we're actually a lot tougher than everybody thinks. So they do try to kind of stick up for themselves and say, hey, we're a bunch of Scottish lads, so we aren't these kind of easygoing people that you might think just because our songs sound really soft and nice.
And he obviously has developed a coterie of friends out in LA, Cian. Isn't Brandon Flowers on?
Yeah, I don't know. Is he?
Yes, he is actually. Surprisingly enough, Brandon Flowers is. You wouldn't actually think it. Brandon Flowers is there, and I think Chris Martin had something to do with the record as well too. There's a particular song where they sing about. Chris Martin is on it, and Brandon Flowers. It's called "Raise the Bar." It's about a bar that we just played.
Yeah. Yes,
yeah. It wouldn't be obvious listening to the track that the two.
No,
of them
it looked like they had a chorus singing along with them.
Yeah,
but very important chorus.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
What did you think of it, Cian?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, you know, having revisited Travis, you know, from the kind of the imperial era and the turn of the millennium, there's a lot more contentment I find here. You know, it doesn't feel as dour, I suppose. It's just as mellow, it's just as melodic. They claimed this was their most personal album since The Man Who. I think that's another classic trope where they say it's the most personal just to sell the record. I don't really feel like I felt this was a man going through anything particular. You know, there was revelry from the past, there was hopes for a better future. but I didn't feel like there was a whole lot new going on. I think he sounded like Tom Petty at times, at Bono at other times. I felt on the track Live It All, it was almost like a Billie Eilish song. I kind of felt, I was wondering, was he inspired by that? That sort of like high falsetto and the kind of
when you say strums. You mean he changes his voice and he can sound like Tom Petty sometimes and Bono and
other times. Absolutely. I think he displays a range of sort of styles. In River, there's this bagpipe sort of bed, which is really interesting. It kind of creates this like Braveheart style, frenetic call to action. But when I was looking through old reviews sort of previous albums, Tim Jones of The Guardian, in a review of 2016, wrote, and I thought this hit the nail on the head of this album too, inoffensive semi-melodies and the same old harmless jangle. And I was like, that's it, Tim, you've got it.
Harmless jangle, oh God.
Okay, we'll have to play another one and see. Look out for the harmless jangle here. Here's Gaslight. So that's Gaslight from Travis, and their album is called LA Times, and Keane Sullivan and Aoife Barry have been listening. I like that more.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I think there's no point in any of these 10 songs make me want to turn them off. I think they're perfectly pleasant, they're palatable, they're serviceable. They're just, none of them made me really want to click repeat on them. The exception, and I'm interested in what you think of this, is the title track, A Total Departure in Sound.
This is LA Times.
LA Times, exactly. It's this sort of spoken, I don't want to say spoken word, but like it isn't sung, it's spoken over this sort of synthy backdrop. You can hear this, he's definitely interacting with the Scottishness in the vocals. Mm. I thought that was a really interesting. I'd like to hear more of that palette with them. And the fact they kind of only did one, I kind of felt like they weren't really ready to commit to that sound. They were kind of like sprinkling it.
That's right to me. I didn't love that in a way, because I think he was kind of, it's kind of his version, Fran Healy's version of aggression on that song, which to me was like, I don't want to listen to too much aggression with Travis. I just want a little bam from my tired brain.
You're back in the 90s. Yeah,
but I do think it's a good point that like it is good to hear them do things like that. They're a little bit different, and hearing that sense of anger towards whatever he's seeing is a point of this record as well too.
Lovely. Stars from you, Aoife.
3.5.
Okay, still liking them. And Cian?
Straight down the middle. 3 out of 5.
3 out of 5. Okay, that's for Travis. Next we have Griff, a.k.a. Sarah Faith Griffith, with her debut album Vertigo. Let's have a listen to the title track.
You're scared of heights, that's vertigo. You wanted lights, go see a show. You ran away, that's touch and go. You're scared of love, well aren't we all, well aren't we all. Is it too much to ask? You're scared of heights, that's vertigo. You wanted life.
let's go see a show. You ran away, that's touch and go. You're scared of love.
So that's the title track there, Vertigo, from Griff's new debut album. So, Cian, I mean, she's had a phenomenal early career because she's in her early 20s and this is her first album, but she's toured with Taylor Swift, Dua Lipa already.
Yeah, absolutely. So her debut song was premiered by Annie Mac on BBC Radio 1 about like a few weeks after her A-levels and she got signed straight away. She got the Brits Rising Star Award. Like you said, Coldplay, Dua Lipa, Taylor Swift have all co-signed her to a certain degree. So she's definitely being a nurtured artist in the UK. This is her debut album. It doesn't sound like her debut album because she had a mixtape in maybe 2021 that was basically like a soft launch of a debut album. So she's been putting out EPs and mixtapes to slowly build to this point. I don't know if it's a great show of faith from, I guess, you know, how from the rollout, but a lot of these songs were available before the release. So I wonder like whether they're sort of trying to drip feed fans to kind of build the hype. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she's been on the go for a good bit.
She's got a very interesting background, hasn't she, Aoife?
Yeah, she's really interesting. So she's an evangelical Christian and was, or maybe still is, a member of the controversial church Hillsong, which is one of the really big evangelical churches, which is in the UK and America as well. And it's, you know, had some interesting things happen there. And she's talked about being an evangelical Christian, which is very unusual for a British pop star, you know, of her age. Her parents are of Chinese and Jamaican heritage. In fact, I think her grandparents came over on the Windrush. So she has this really interesting background. And also added to that, she started making music basically in secret, didn't really tell people about it, got signed, like Cian was saying, during her A-levels, and then took a year out to make music. And her first gig was at the Brits, I think. So, you know, she's someone who has this kind of pandemic era career, you know, where hidden away and then kind of able to come out when the world opens.
And were you satisfied with the album? Is that what you expected, or did you expect something more, something bigger?
It definitely sounds really polished, in that she has a really solid idea of herself and her sound. There's some really big tracks on this. I mean, there's a song called Miss Me Too, which sounded really like Robin to me. You know, it's a really kind of confident dance floor song, but it felt in the middle of the record it kind of loses itself. It becomes kind of derivative and sounds like, I wasn't too sure what song I was listening to at one point in the middle. But I do think like this is a debut album that, like Cian was saying, is a collection of songs for the most part that are from EPs. So it's not, it's understandable that at this point this record would be like that.
Well, we have that song here, Miss Me Too. Let's listen to a little.
There was something so bitter and cold in my eyes then. Like a lucid dream, like a rosy tint on a glass lens. And I thought I would be all so old again. Oh, and what a time we had. I drank the drinks, I shook the hands, and I believed the past.
So that's Miss Me Too from Vertigo by Griff. So a good debut?
I think so. I think she shows a lot of promise. I think her voice is brilliant. You know, even you hear in that track, Miss Me, it's kind of strong and weak in equal parts. You know, it kind of sounds like she's both like on the cusp of crying and screaming at you at the same time, but obviously incredibly melodically and sweet. I think, you know, she's also a producer. She's produced a good chunk of this album as well. And I think that's really interesting. You know, you hear the sparse production. There's lots of negative space in there at times. I felt the album had a really nice sense of transit. The way the loops were, I kind of felt like I could picture the movement as the songs were going on.
Definitely.
She has a great sense of drama as well in the production as well. I feel at times the songs slowly expand and then contract suddenly and expand back out again with these big drum noises. So she certainly has, you know, maybe not perfected, but really like honed her craft. I think Aoife's right in that, like, I think she has the same bag of tricks over 13 songs that she probably could have finessed down. I really liked Anything, which is one of the songs. It has this 12-8 melody, and it just really is both, it kind of finesses those two things that she has, drama and sense of transit, okay, really, really well.
So from you, Cian, stars out of five?
I gave it 3.5 because 3.5. I feel like she, although she's shown promise, I don't think she's reached her end goal of what she wants to be yet.
Aoife?
Yeah, 3.5 as well, just because that dip in the middle brought it down for me.
Okay, so that's 3.5 and 3.5 for Griff with her debut album, Vertigo. And finally, Big Ideas from Remy Wolf, a former Olympic skier and contestant on The American Idol. Let's have a listen to the album opener. This is Cinderella. Sorry, we were just chatting. Sorry about that. But we were listening very carefully to Remy Wolf's Cinderella. Now, tell us about Remy Wolf. Aoife.
Yeah, so she is a young Californian, like you're saying, again, has an interesting background, you know, former competitive skier, and ends up being a really talented singer and performer. And she, again, is someone who's brought out a couple of EPs. This is her second album. Her first album, Juno, came out in 2021. You know, and I think it's actually interesting as a side note to see younger artists bringing out EPs, which I felt for a little while were kind of like a dead format, but now we're definitely used a lot more as kind of a testing ground for people. And so for this second album, she's really gone into this kind of, as you could hear, kind of funk soul sound, really, really groovy. She's influenced by artists including the American artist Toro y Moi, who's really, really great. He's not hugely necessarily well known in Ireland, but if you listen to any of his albums, you'll really hear similar vibes going on. But across this record, she tries so many different kind of hats on for style. She, you know, she's kind of got 80s synths going one minute. She feels like she's written like a 50s kind of ballad at another moment on the song.
And does Motorcycle. That work, all these different styles?
I think she manages to tie it all together really well, mainly because vocally her vocals are really interesting. And then lyrically, she's a really honest, vulnerable lyricist. She's really writing about her, you know, everyday life and her kind of, you know, strife as a touring musician, as a young woman trying to make her way in the world. And I heard bands from like Jane's Addiction to Alex G, you know, her influences are far and wide and they all tie together really nicely. And I really, really loved that opening song, Cinderella. I think it really sets out the tone for the record.
Yes, Cian, because it's a big thing calling your album Big Ideas, but it sounds from Aoife like they are big ideas. She has lots of ideas.
Well, certainly lots of ideas. All right. Like when I first listened through, when I got back to Cinderella, which is the opening track, I was like, oh yeah, this is how this all started. There was so many different sounds. Like I think in my notes I wrote that it was like watching a makeover montage of a Gary Marshall movie, this, because there's just so many different styles that she puts on and off. But I really loved her production. You know, all the backing vocal, like, instrumentation is kind of all psychedelic in a way that you can't really feel where one instrument starts and one instrument ends. And I was thinking about that a lot, and I was reading about her, and it turns out she has ADHD, and I was like, I think that makes a lot of sense. I imagine this is the sort of kaleidoscopic vision you get if you have ADHD, which I don't, so I don't know what it's like. But I thought, like, she's like Griff, she's also a producer, and I think that's really where this album comes into its foray.
Okay, and who has she collaborated in terms of production on this, or is it mainly coming from herself?
I'm actually not too sure myself who she worked with production wise.
Yeah, no, no wonder why. But I think, like, you know, she obviously has a lot of references going on. You know, that she's trying to do a bit of everything, and I mean, like Griff, she's also a support on the tours as well. She's been supporting Olivia Rodrigo on her tour across Europe, which is the role that Chappell Roan did in the US, and she's only gone from strength to strength over the last few months. So
she gives off really major Chappell Roan vibes. I think that idea of like a young female musician who's like got a grab bag of influences and is very confidently picking from them and very confidently creating her own world around her and her own sound at such a young age as well. I mean, probably the weaker part of the album is that it's big ideas and there's all this stuff going on and you're maybe trying to like orientate yourself in this kaleidoscope of being, hang on, where am I? What's happening? But it's actually, for me, I felt a lot more excited listening to this record than listening to Griff's record. But I wondered if that was just down to my own taste, because I would lean more towards listening to the type of music she was influenced by. So I think if you're someone who does love your kind of classic, you know, vintage soul, does like your Olivia Rodrigo, who takes massively from the grunge era, she also takes from grunge as well here on a couple of tracks.
Alone in Miami, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I think if you like her influences, you'll like this record, but you might be waiting for the third one where there's maybe a more cohesive thing going on in this.
So I think you both picked out Soup. Do any of you want to talk me into this one?
I just love the 80s synth pop of this track. You know, it comes right after Cinderella and it's a real pivot, but it sounds like so fresh and new. But her glint in her eye and her personality managed to be the common thread between both of them.
That is Soup from Remy Wolf, and the name of the album is Big Ideas. Now, in terms of lyrics, I think you thought there was some vulnerability in what she sang about, but you less so, Cian, I think.
Yeah,
I think she, like, there's one particular lyric where she says, I think it's in Cinderella, where she says, "Is there something wrong with the way I'm designed? Can't find comfort in anything." And I just felt like that's a very vulnerable lyric straight away to open the album with that. And also probably everybody listening to the record totally knows what that feeling is as well too. And she also talks about, you know, being on tour and the song On Just the Start. She says, "I don't want to party, but I don't really want to work. Either way, I'll be lonely. Either way, I'm cursed." So, you know, I love that, like, the younger musicians coming up now are actually talking about how difficult it is to be in the career that they're in, which has so many more pressures in different ways than their predecessors, and they're really interrogating that through their songs.
Yeah, you thought, I think, that she kept us a little at a distance.
Yeah, I kind of felt like, although, like, she took, like, I think, you know, in Frog Rock, another one where she talks about, like, I don't want to see my ex looking good, like, I want you to look bad because you're my ex. But I think, like, I find it's always wrapped in a kind of a joke and a wink, in rather than, like, this is pure from the heart. This is, like, kind of, you know, like, I'm not doing okay, but your peace sign, and let's just have a laugh through it. I kind of felt was the vibe.
Social media kind of, exactly. Appearances versus reality.
Yeah, sad girl summer.
Okay. Hashtag.
So Aoife, stars from you for Remy Wolf and Big Ideas.
Once again, and this I don't think has ever happened before, that I've given all the albums the same stars 1 week. It's 3.5. Everything's just didn't quite reach to the 4 for me.
And what about you, Cian?
Yeah, I really enjoyed the kaleidoscopic aspect of this sort of sapphic pop from her. So yeah, I gave it 4 stars.
4 stars. Oh, very good. So 4 and 3.5 for Remy Wolf and Big Ideas. The other albums were Griff, Vertigo, and Travis, LA Times.